If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I can always remember detectives coming around, new information, talking to mom about different things, you know, but they just kept hitting dead ends. You know, my mom worked really closely with a lot of the investigators for a long time. It was probably hardest on her than anybody, and she suffered a lot through it.
After the abduction and murder of Carla Walker in February of 1974, the police loosely theorized a possible connection to two prior unsolved homicides. These murders shared some similarities with Carla's, one of which is the month that the crimes took place. The headline-hunting press seemed to be more enamored with the idea of connection than police, or at least more than the police let on, and without hesitation dubbed the homicides the February slayings. There are certain details that are almost eerily common between these murders. Mildred May fell first in this sequence of unsolved cases, the February slayings. The small town of Alto was once home to the seat of the Tejas Confederacy, a confederation of the Caddo-speaking Native American tribes of the region for which Texas got its name. Named at its inception in 1849 for the Spanish word for high, due to its elevation, Alto sits atop a drainage divide between the Neches and Angelina rivers. Mildred Laura Boykin was born on October 15, 1928 in this densely forested but sparsely populated southeast Texas town to Laura and James Albert Boykin. She was one of several children. Mildred met John McDonald May, who was simply known as Mac, when they were young. The two hit it off immediately and were crazy about each other from the get-go. They were married in 1945. Mildred was 16 years old and Mac was 20. The couple gave birth to their only child, Joanne, 9 months later. Mildred and Mac talked about leaving Southeast Texas since they met. They had bigger ambitions than what the deep country could provide. And in 1951, Mildred and Mac set their sights on Fort Worth. It could easily be assumed that the little big city of Fort Worth seemed welcoming since it could satisfy their desires for a better life while maintaining the feel, comfort, and hospitality of a small community. Mildred and Mac's granddaughter, Devaney, is among the few family members still living with a direct tie to them.
My grandfather was like from an Indian reservation. Grew up on the Indian reservation in East Texas. He was from Lufkin, and she was from a little town right out of Lufkin. It's right in the middle of the forest, and just a farmer's girl. They both came from really big families. I think one of the younger ones. And they were very poor, and she met my grandfather and got married young, and they left town, and they were headed to Fort Worth to find jobs and do something with their lives instead of sit around there in East Texas, and they wanted to be more. I would say they were probably partiers, you know. They went to beer joints and danced and lived it up. As far as their families looked up to them because they had good jobs, cars, bought a house, had nice clothing. They were just making something for themselves, and now they were like city folk, you know. I don't know. They both worked hard. They played hard. And I know they probably drank quite a bit of beer. They both worked hard, you know, to have nice things. They definitely enjoyed life together. And I mean, they would go home to Luskin and always take gifts back to everybody, to the other sisters and brothers and stuff. And she was really admired by a lot of her neighbors and her friends and her family. She was, you know, tall and elegant and very beautiful and I don't know. She was quite a dresser. It's like one of the things I remember about her is having really nice purses and clothes, and she always dressed my mom really nice clothes and everything. I've seen a lot of pictures of her in like some red petal pushers or white top and gold shoes, you know, just, you know, she looked nice, but it wasn't too flashy or anything. There's a lot of photos I have for my grandfather, you know, her in like a one-piece bathing suit in the backyard, sitting on a towel, probably sunning and posing for him. And so I see that he really thought she was beautiful. He took a lot of pictures of her dressed up or casual. Looks like he really admired her beauty.
Mack worked a few different jobs before settling for a position at Texas Steel Company in the warehouse, where he would work until he retired, moving up the ladder in the course. 16 years later, in 1969, after the family had more than established their footing in Fort Worth, Mildred and Mack's daughter, Joanne, was 20 and married, with two kids of her own. Mildred, now 38, had landed a job the previous year as a soldering technician at Howell Instruments, a company that makes aircraft cockpit engine instrumentation, among many other tools and aircraft monitoring equipment. Mack had just landed the warehouse supervisor position. They'd recently celebrated their 22nd wedding anniversary and had moved into a new modest 2-bedroom red brick home. The two had many friends, and their neighbors described them as friendly, congenial, and fun to be around. Life was everything the couple had hoped for when they dreamt about leaving the small southeast Texas town of Alto many years back. On February 3rd, 1967, payday, Mildred left work and stopped by the grocery store on her way home. When Mack arrived home from work at 3:30 p.m., she was already home, spread out on the couch. She told him she didn't feel well, that she had a headache. Mildred was prone to severe headaches, and in fact was under a doctor's care for the condition. At 5:30 p.m., Mack was headed to Dallas to attend a company function, strangely described as a wild game dinner and stag party. His car had been having fuel pump issues, so Mack was using Mildred's car to drive the 30 or so miles to Dallas. "Have a good time and be home early," she told her husband. Mack replied, "How late can I stay out?" "Young man, you'd better be home by the stroke of midnight," Mildred jokingly said. The day turned to dusk, and the temperature would eventually drop into the 30s on this night. At 6:15 p.m., her daughter, Joanne, called to ask Mildred to accompany her and her husband to dinner. "Your father's gone to Dallas," she told Joanne, "and I am here alone. I'm going to eat, bathe, and go to bed," Mildred told her.
My mom said, whenever she had talked to her, that she was cooking a steak, and I was reading in the paper that she had told the police she could actually hear the steak sizzling as my grandmother was, you know, she's like, "I'm cooking a steak right now and I'm just going to stay in. I have a headache." My dad seems to think that a girl that she worked with was having an affair and needed Mildred to come out to come with her that night. I don't know that she for sure had been with her. I didn't see that in any of the papers that she had for sure met a friend, but somebody had said they had seen her with a brunette. So somebody had placed her there, but it's a place that she had gone before.
A coworker or neighbor, it was reported as both in the papers, also talked to her at 7:30 p.m., who told her the same thing. But Mildred did go out. As late as 10:30 p.m., a family friend spoke to her at the El Matador Club. She was wearing gold flat shoes, gold stretch pants, a white blouse that had 3/4-length sleeves that ended in lace ruffles, and a suede knee-length brown coat. Mildred's accessories included a silver and gold watch, a gold purse, and pearl necklace that belonged to her daughter. El Matador Club was located on Camp Bowie Boulevard, on what is known as the traffic circle. This establishment is about 8.4 miles from her house, but since the Fort Worth Stock Show and Rodeo began on this day, the traffic was heavy and slow. It's estimated that it would have taken Mildred approximately 27 minutes to drive to El Matador Club from her home. Two other individuals, who were co-workers, also saw her at the club, and she was reported to have left between 10:30 and 10:40 p.m., presumably to return home. She told an acquaintance that her car was having issues and asked if they could wait to see if it started. It started, and Mildred left the El Matador Club. Mac returned home at around 12:30 a.m. from the company dinner party he had attended. Though she didn't leave a note, as she normally did, Mac wasn't worried because Mildred had mentioned that she might go visit with friends. He got into bed and went to sleep. At 6:30 a.m. on Saturday, February 4th, Mac opened his eyes, peering at Mildred's side of the bed. She wasn't there. He rose and made his way to the second bedroom to see if she'd gone to bed there as to not disturb him, but she also wasn't there. Mac immediately went to the phone and began calling every friend and relative he could think of, including their daughter, Joanne. Since no one had heard from Mildred, Mac called the police to report her missing, telling them, "My wife's gone." Joanne arrived at her parents' house shortly after, and as the confused and distressed family impatiently waited for news as to the whereabouts of Mildred, the phone rang. It was now 10:30 a.m. Joanne picked up the receiver, and before she could put it to her ear, she heard heavy breathing. "Hello," Joanne greeted. The caller hung up. The phone rang again 10 minutes later, but like in the previous call, only heavy breathing followed by silence would be heard. Mac contacted the phone company, asking that a tracer be put on the telephone line. At 11:15 a.m., the phone rang again. Joanne picked it up, and there was silence. She held the receiver off the hook, and the caller never spoke. Though the phone company was unable to determine the number from which the call came, they were able to ascertain that it had come from the 535 Exchange, also called the Jefferson Exchange, or Southeast Fort Worth. Presumably, around the same time the last call was occurring, a friend of Mac and Mildred, Bill Luddington, was driving to the Maze from Weatherford for a visit. As he passed the Clover Lane exit on the West Freeway, he noticed what looked like Mac's 1959 white Pontiac parked in the shoulder. Bill didn't think anything of it until he arrived at the home and was told that Mildred could not be found. Police arrived at the scene of the car shortly thereafter, and it was indeed Mr. Mays. It would have taken Mildred an estimated 10 minutes to get to this location from the El Matador Club. The vehicle was locked, and Mac was summoned to the scene. When he arrived, he unlocked the car. There appeared to be no evidence of a struggle. None of Mildred's belongings were reported present in the automobile. The police asked Mac to drive to the Fort Worth Police Department's crime lab, but as he attempted to, the motor died. A wrecker was called, and the car was towed. The police thoroughly checked the vehicle, but no clues were found, including fingerprints. An attendant at Homer Gann's Texaco service station, located on University Drive, about 2.3 miles from where the Mays vehicle was found, told police that a woman had stopped there complaining of fuel line trouble the evening of Friday the 3rd. He was unable to identify Mildred as this woman.
Dad said that where her car broke down, there was like a big hill or something there. And he's like, so she probably wanted to climb that hill to get over to the access road. She probably just walked down the access road. But there was a telephone booth and a gas station right there that she could have made it to. But he's like, I don't think she ever made it there.
The same afternoon, two youths riding motorbikes along a beaten path that winded alongside the Trinity River started to joyride down a slope off this path, but stopped cold at a grisly sight. A woman's body lied in the tall grass on the side of the steep levee on the west fork of the Trinity River, just 70 feet east of the North Freeway, at the Carver Lane exit. The two youths quickly rode to a nearby grocery store to call the police and report what they'd found. The call was made at 1:40 p.m. The body of Mildred Laura May was found lying face down at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 4th, 1967. She was nude except for her diamond-studded wedding ring. Her red hair was matted with blood. Mildred's body was mangled, covered in bruises, scratches, and blood. One officer at the scene remarked, "You could holler out here for an hour and no one would hear you." Mildred's body was taken to All Saints Hospital for an autopsy after the scene where she was found was scoured. Chief Medical Examiner Felix Gwotz determined death to be fixed at between 1:30 and 3:30 a.m. early Saturday morning. Dr. Gwotz found the skin on Mildred's back and hips to be badly torn, indicating she had been dragged across gravel by her feet. It should be noted here that there was no gravel near the levee where she was found. Her body was a solid mass of abrasions, cuts, and bruises. There had been heavy hemorrhaging from her head and face injuries. There was a slender mark around Mildred's throat, leading Dr. Gwotz to determine that she'd been strangled with a flexible instrument such as a rope, belt, or cord. The injuries to Mildred's neck were severe. A bone in her neck had been fractured and her larynx crushed. Her eyes had been blacked, most likely due to the violent strangulation. Dr. Gwotz's opinion is that Mildred's body had been dumped after death. Mildred had also been sexually assaulted. Later, Mac and Joanne arrived at the All Saints morgue to identify the body. Joanne was shown a wedding ring topped with 12 clear stones. "Oh, Daddy," she began sobbing, "that belongs to Mother." Joanne put the ring in her pocket. The medical examiner pinched the edges of a sheet covering the form of a body. It looked like a silhouette, and lifted it, exposing the deceased woman. Mac looked at the body. "That's her. That's Mildred," he stated. On Sunday, February 5th, 7 homicide detectives and 25 motorcyclists emerged on the scene of the riverbank where Mildred's body was found to comb the area for evidence. Mac and Joanne had been on the scene just prior.
I know after they found her body and brought her in, my mom and my grandfather went down to the morgue and identified her. And I think that afternoon, the police took them to the site where they found her body. And Dad said it really pissed him off. The police department had used a Polaroid camera to take pictures of her body laying there. And, of course, when they pulled off the paper part of it, I don't know if you remember Polaroids, but black negative paper, and he said there were 3 or 4 of those laying around. You could pick them up and see it was of Mildred, her nude body laying there, and they left him at the scene. That just seemed like really sloppy police work.
Because blood was soaked a half an inch into the ground where her body had laid, Fort Worth police believed Mildred died on the grassy slope in the dust and weeds. She would have bled considerably where she was killed. Detectives theorized someone drove a car from Carver Street onto the levee, through a field of tall grass, and pushed the body out, hoping Mildred would roll down the levee. But their efforts were hampered by the tall grass, police guessed, and since they could not find any sign of a car being driven in the grass, the perpetrator must have dragged her to the spot she was found and then strangled her until she died. They believe Mildred had been beaten and raped somewhere else. Lieutenant Oliver Ball believed that she was abducted and terrorized for around 5 hours before she was raped and strangled. This suggests a time of death at around 4 a.m. As the police's theory grew, they came to believe that Mac's car had broken down, leaving Mildred stranded. She locked the car and walked to a phone booth that was less than a block away from where the car had failed, was abducted on the way to the phone booth, or accepted a ride from someone who then abducted and killed her, police thought. More than 100 phone calls bombarded the Fort Worth Police Department immediately upon the paper's reporting of the homicide, all claiming to have seen a man they felt might be connected or who'd found clothing. Every call was checked out. At noon on Thursday, February 9th, 1967, a street cleaning crew found some personal items that belonged to Mildred on the 1900 block of West Freeway near the 15th Street exit on the south side of the median. This location is 25 blocks from where the car was found, or about 2.3 miles east, and an approximate 2-minute, 45-second drive at the speed limit. The items found included a small pink and white plastic wallet, an employee ID from Howell Instruments, a crumpled and torn photo of Joanne, and an Edison Jeweler discount card. The way the items were strewn indicated that they were thrown from a moving car or more specifically, thrown from the driver's side window from the inside eastbound lane. A 2-foot rope with red hair tangled in it was also found near this location. It had knots tied at both ends and was frayed in two places like it had almost been broken. The rope was determined to be a window sash cord, which were connected to pulleys in the windows of older homes. Mac provided detectives with Mildred's hairbrush to get a sample to compare to the hair found on the sash cord, and it was said not to have matched. Though it might be called into question just how precise and reliable hair analysis was in the 1960s. It is known the hair on the sash cord was concluded not to match Mildred's hair because they were different textures, but it was only tested against a single strand of hair from her brush, and it is common for textures to differ between the hairs of a single individual. Police discarded the sash cord. An hour after the cord was found, on the 2000 block of West Freeway, just west of 15th Street, Mildred's driver's license, a container of headache pills, a picture of Joanne and of Mildred's grandchildren, as well as a plastic tube containing two other types of pills were found. The police were unable to lift prints from Mildred's wallet due to its texture. There were many items missing from her wallet. Credit cards from Gulf, Humble, Lion, Fina Oil, Stripling's department stores, and Monig's department stores, among others. What was described as a greasy fingerprint found on the facing of a closet door in a bedroom of the Mays home was lifted, but didn't match any prints on police record. The police thought that finding Mildred's clothes was the best perspective for solving the case. Lieutenant Detective Oliver Ball remarked, "You find her clothes, you find the murder scene." The police were obsessively adamant about finding a blood-stained car. They were sure that Mildred had bled profusely in a spot other than where she was found. An abandoned vehicle that appeared stained with either red mud or blood spots on its dash, front seat around the doors, trunk, and body of the car was found near the northbound lane on the 2200 block of Fifth Avenue. Presumably, since the car faded into media obscurity, it wasn't connected. Perhaps the stains were caused by the reddish-brown clays and soils common in the rolling red prairies in the area. Several friends and family members were cleared by police questioning or lie detector tests. Though Mac was never a suspect, a fact that detectives insisted on since the beginning, he requested that the police put him on a polygraph machine so the results would be, quote, on the record. Questions included, did you choke your wife? And did you see Mildred late Friday night or early Saturday morning? Mac answered no to these inquiries and answered many other questions in the 40-minute lie detector test. The test showed that Mac had no knowledge of the crime. A neighbor reported seeing Mac's white 1959 Pontiac leaving the home at about 12:30 a.m. early Saturday morning and said it was occupied by two people. Mac said this was impossible, however, because he was home earlier than that. Police were attempting to find an older model car that a passerby reported being near the spot where the body was discovered at around 10:30 p.m. Friday. The car was seen climbing up the grassy slope onto Carver Street. An off-duty police officer told investigators he'd seen a car parked on that levee at about 11 p.m. Friday night. A 31-year-old who was described as a strong-looking man and asked his name not to be published in the press believes he saw two people in a struggle on top of the levee between the hours of 1:30 and 1:45 a.m. early Saturday. The River Oaks resident said he thought about intervening but decided to call police instead. He claims to have gone to a payphone on Northeast 28th Street and North Freeway, made an attempt to call, but says he dialed the wrong number and went on home. The man says he drove by the next day and saw a crowd of people at the same spot, but figured it was people watching motorcycle races. He'd only become aware that he might have seen a crime taking place, he said, after reading the newspaper account the next day. He then called a friend who was with the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office to report what he declared he'd seen. The man told police that he was traveling northbound on the North Freeway, going home, when he glanced at the levee and saw two individuals struggling with a dark-colored 1955 model Ford a few feet away from where Mildred's body would be found. The vehicle was parked in front of two well-lit billboards. The lights from the billboards shone down on the car. He said the illumination from the billboards allowed him to see an African-American and a Caucasian fighting. The African American had pulled the Caucasian against him in a hole. They both appeared to be the same height, the man said. He initially thought the Caucasian was a man who didn't have his shirt on, but after reading the news reports, believed it was a woman. The scuffle was described as taking place within 100 feet from where Mildred's body was found. The unnamed man told reporters he'd had a few drinks that night, and he was driving home from a bar that closed about midnight. He and some friends had stayed in the parking lot after the bar closed, he claimed, drinking beer for more than an hour. He was sure he left the parking lot after 1:30 a.m. and believed it to be closer to 2 a.m. The man said he didn't pay much attention to what was happening on the levee and that he wished he had. He told the papers the guy was probably all pilled up that night. He did not want his name published because, he went on, a guy that will do this is capable of doing anything. Detectives described this witness as reliable, as he was a personal friend of a sheriff's investigator. However, the account sounds almost too convenient to be true. A black man chooses to kill a white woman under a billboard that provided enough light for anyone traveling the freeway to have an incredible view of the events happening just 70 feet away as they pass, and around 100 yards from a majority African-American neighborhood. The police also felt that the witness's story fit with the known facts of the investigation. Perhaps knowledge of the facts of this investigation could be taken in another way.
He said he didn't have the number for the police department, or he would have called the police at that time. He waited later, and I guess after he saw the reports and said, oh, I'd seen something, and he would have been a suspect to me because he's like, if he'd gone to a payphone at the time, he said the police phone number was on every phone in the city. Or he could have dialed zero and gotten the operator involved.
A few other suspects emerged, but it is unknown just how or why they were eliminated. As time passed, the press moved on to covering other stories and current events, which put an end to the demand for answers from police in Mildred's case. In June of 1969, Carlos Don Stultz, 26, was arrested in Mejia, Texas, for the stabbing death of a 17-year-old girl. Stultz would subsequently be charged with the murder of an 11-year-old girl in Grand Prairie, not far from Fort Worth, in 1968, which led police to consider him for Mildred's murder. Police tried for months to question Stultz, but were stifled in their efforts by his attorney. He was questioned for a homicide in Dallas and eliminated, but it is unknown if he has ever been questioned by the Fort Worth Police Department or the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office in Mildred's murder. There are other possibilities.
There was a man that lived just a couple of blocks from them, and a couple of weeks before her murder, a zoo employee had written a letter to the police department that she had been raped by this man. And she was saying he was a fellow zoo employee. She was, it's funny how extreme the sexism and everything was back in the 60s. I mean, they were like, she's a divorcee. So basically, I guess they were saying since she was a divorcee, it implied that being raped was probably maybe her own fault, or that maybe she had brought it on herself. And the fact that she didn't reach out to the police afterwards, she wrote a letter to them and just said, this man has a arsenal of weapons and grenades, and he had handcuffed her to the bed. He had recorded the whole thing and had a camera automatically taking photos of them while he was raping her. So they checked him out, and he only lived a couple of blocks away from my grandparents, and they actually had brought him in and given him a lie detector test and passed it. So funny that whoever was running all of this relied so heavily on lie detector tests, because they gave lie detector tests to my grandfather, both of my parents, you know, other people who worked with her, and if they pass it, they kind of wrote you off like, oh, you're not a suspect. So funny, because even today's standards, they don't really rely on it heavily because people can get around it. It just wasn't an exact science, and still isn't. But anyways, that would have been my first suspect, is this guy that lives a couple of blocks away and has a history of raping. I can always remember detectives coming around. They mentioned the name Kaiser. They were going to test some evidence, and I never did hear back, but it sounded like he is already in the prison system and either had confessed or they had something that could connect him to the crime. Supposedly, this Kaiser, I think he may have been in prison or something and may have confessed to several area murders. But, you know, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, these guys, if he is still alive, he's probably at least mid-80s to 90s. And, you know, Dad was telling me something I didn't know, that my grandparents had actually separated at one point, because I found her Social Security card with an Arlington address, and I actually Googled it and looked at it, a little bitty wood house that's still standing over in Arlington. And I said, I didn't realize they had lived in Arlington. And he said, they didn't. He said, they separated at one point and were separated for several months. And he said, your mom and Mildred lived in Arlington for a couple of months. And he said, she started seeing a guy that she worked with at Howe Instruments. And my grandfather was seeing other ladies at the time. But they worked things out and got back together. Well, it was after she died that my mom brought up, I wonder about the guy that she dated for a little bit from Howe Instruments. And I don't think my grandfather knew about it and got pretty angry, jealous about it. I don't know. My dad said that my mom called him and said, you know, do you hear about my mom? He's like, yeah. And anyway, the detective had tried to tell her, try and get a meeting with him, meeting for a cup of coffee or something like that. So they made a time to meet, and the moment he arrived, they basically handcuffed him and took him in for questioning. I'm like, why didn't they just go to his house? Pretty elaborate to try and talk to this guy and put my mom in the middle of it. But, you know, through the years, they tried to follow up on leads and different people, but they always just kept kind of coming up empty-handed.
Two detectives were present at Mildred's funeral on the Monday afternoon following her death in hopes of turning up more information and to observe attendees. Nothing was learned. Mildred Laura May was laid to rest on February 6, 1967, at 2 p.m. at Laurel Land Memorial Park. Though Mac May had remarried, he was buried next to Mildred when he died on August 25, 1987. If you have any information about the murder of Mildred May, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, The February Slayings, Part 2, Becky Martin. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing the podcast with a friend, or by stopping over at our Patreon page to make a small donation. These donations help cover the costs associated with the research and production, and we appreciate them immensely. We'd like to thank Mildred's granddaughter, Devaney, for her contribution to this episode. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook and Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases we cover and post pictures and articles, so please join in. Also, if you enjoy reading about fascinating true crime cases, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The cases are well presented and always interesting and thorough. Thetruecrimefiles.com never disappoints. Thanks for listening, y'all.